Welcome to another edition of Oncology Today. This program focuses on the role of BTK inhibitors in the management of patients with mantle cell lymphoma. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Michael Wang from the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. And in addition to this interview, there's also a corresponding video program featuring Dr. Wang's slide presentation. To begin, I asked them about the issue of management of patients presenting with so-called smoldering mantle cell lymphoma, in which observation is one of the considered options.
A lot of community doctors and academic doctors, they see the patient have no symptoms at all. They would choose the observation. But sometimes they're not sure this is a patient to me, and I start treatment. So the smoldering mantle cell lymphoma is very rare. Smoldering is even more rare, okay? So most likely, most scenario is the CLL type of mantle cell lymphoma. Mantle cell lymphoma present like CLL. They're in the marrow, in the spleen, in the blood, but there's no lymph nodes, okay? And those patients even have a p53 mutation, you may not have to treat them for years. But there's no criteria when to start a therapy. Usually the patient have significant cytopenia. They are feeling bad. Basically, here's my criteria. Spleen cannot be over 20 centimeters. Okay, and of course, you have to adjust the size. This is for a mid-sized man. If you have a fine small lady, the patient has an 18 centimeter spleen, but the patient is small and is already having problems, so you need to pay attention. What are the main, the spleen is causing symptoms? What are the main issues? Early satiety, discomfort from the spleen. And sometimes the spleen can ache. That's, you have to make sure that there's ongoing infarctions in there. You have to treat the patient early, okay? The second criteria is I do not allow the WBC to be over 30%. Not a 30% over WBC 30 in the lymphocytosis in the peripheral blood. I do not want allow them over 30. Okay, 30K basically 30,000. So if you allow them to go up the fatigue level, the viscosity, the PEs and the strokes, bowel ischemia is going to kick in. And the art of the treating mantle cell lymphoma is to heat the lymphoma before it causes any damage or symptoms. By the time you have symptoms, that means you are already too late by 3 or 4 months, okay? Please remember that. Our art of treating mantle cell lymphoma is like a good dental procedure. In the past, we have severe pain with all these procedures. Now we go there, we have no pain. The same thing, mantle cell lymphoma should be treated with a discomfort-free stage rather than discomfort already knocked in, you're already too late, okay? The other issues for the smoldering mantle cell lymphoma, I do not wait for the mantle cell lymphoma lymphadenopathy to be over 2.5 centimeters. If you reach 3 or 4 centimeters, you know mantle cell lymphoma also has transformation. Like Richter's transformation from CLL, follicular lymphoma transforming, large cell lymphoma, mantle cell lymphoma is constantly transforming. They can start with a KIC less than 30%, you know, progression maybe 50%. They may not have P53 mutations in the progression. They may acquire P53. They may start with a classical nodular diffuse type. They may become pleomorphic blastoid in the progression. You do not allow the lymph node to be too big to have that chance to be increased. You need to hit it before it has any chance to transform. So I usually start at 2 centimeters. So I definitely do not allow it to be 2.5. I think if you do that, some of the lymphomas in the body, it may, you know, you may lose the chance, right? So therefore, when I see this patient from the community, I usually start them with therapy. I convince the patient, you cannot, okay? I hope that answered the question, Neil.
Yeah, that's very interesting. What about patients with GI involvement who are asymptomatic? Do you ever see people who just have GI involvement and are asymptomatic? What do you think about observing them? I'm also curious, I've heard a couple cases of people with major GI bleeds. What kinds of complications you see with GI involvement?
So GI sometimes you see a patient with GI, you do the scope with the random biopsies. The whole GI is positive. 30 biopsies, they are all positive mantle cell lymphoma. The patient has not lost weight, no abdominal pain, no bleeding, no diarrhea. So of course, you know, I would not, if the patient present like that, I'm not going to wait for anymore. But I occasionally have major GI bleeding, mostly from the upper GI. When the stomach is involved with the ulcers and with the duodenum, you got to treat the patient quickly, okay? Otherwise, you're going to have patient ulcers, bleeding, and of course, sometimes if the patient have last one lymphoma, the patient have no bleeding, do not panic. That's you can observe this patient for a while, but I choose to attack if there's too much lymphoma, if there's any symptoms or any hint of danger. It's gastric ulcer, duodenal ulcer with the lymphoma. I mean, not only mantle cell goes to GI, like follicular lymphoma can also go there. So those cases, you want it to be aggressive.
Do all patients with mantle cell need upper and lower endoscopy, even if they don't have any GI symptoms?
In my opinion, I always do. I may not do it in the beginning because, you know, if you don't find the lymphoma in the beginning, if the lymph node is too big, you need to treat. And if the lymph node is too big, the GI, you know, has lymphoma, you still have to treat. It doesn't alter. But when I confer the remission, I absolutely need the PET scan active. Everybody agrees it. Bone marrow needs to be confirmed. I always do that. And some people, when the PET scan is negative, they don't do the bone marrow. But at MD Anderson, we use the most stringent idea criteria of CR. PET negative, bone marrow table, and upper and lower GI EGD colonoscopy with random biopsies has to be all negative. Okay. Now, if the patient started with a negative colon down somewhere else, I would not do the confirmation. But they have to, in a lot of cases, they do colonoscopy without biopsies. That does not count. I still have to confirm the CR by upper and lower with random biopsies.
So let's talk about first-line therapy. I want to start out talking about younger patients. And I'm curious, outside of a clinical trial, how you were managing patients typically prior to Triangle, whether that changed. And how you would how you're managing them today outside of a trial, and would that change at all if you could do whatever you want, put aside reimbursement, would you still be doing the same thing?
So a Triangle, if the patient present to me, I would use Triangle data to use ibrutinib, rituximab, maintenance for 2 years instead of the transplant. So for the younger patients. I sometimes would treat the patient according to the window 2 trial with the ibrutinib rituximab venetoclax if they have high risks. Because so far, my response relapse rate is almost zero with the window 2 using the so, but you know, sometimes I would explain to the patient, right? So the ibrutinib is, it has, you know, associated with a sudden death, associated with atrial fibrillation. I would like to use the acalabrutinib to replace ibrutinib. And I already presented the data. And, you know, 90% I can get insurance approval, but sometimes in other areas, this may meet resistance from the insurance. Yeah, so basically, I prefer chemo-free therapies for both populations, older and younger.
So outside a clinical trial right now, what is your, again, outside of a clinical trial, what's your usual approach to the older patient first line?
Yeah, so the first line, we published the in JSEO from my group, rituximab, ibrutinib, the response is almost 100% patient, you know, stay for a long time. However, 24% of patient had atrial fibrillation. So I'm no longer using that. We just presented the data in Lugano. We use acalabrutinib and the rituximab. Very few patients have atrial fibrillation, maybe one or two among 50. And we are using acalabrutinib rituximab to treat the frontline patients with elderly patients. I'm not using BR. I'm not using, you know, I'm using chemo-free therapies.
And what do you use second line?
Second line, so if the patient has, you know, frontline therapy, had ibrutinib, I prefer to use a pirtobrutinib. You know, and then if the patient relapsed aggressively, I would consider CAR T.
All right, let's hear about this 45-year-old woman. What happened with her?
Yeah, well, this is a 45-year-old young lady with a relapsed mantle cell lymphoma who is taking acalabrutinib. 3 days into the treatment course, the patient developed a severe headache. She was not able to function at all and experiencing extreme nausea and vomiting on many occasions. With a dark pair of glasses, she covering her eyes, she came to the clinic with her eyes covered by a dark pair of glasses, asking for your help. So what is the following we should do? A, stop acalabrutinib immediately. B, ask if this patient has a history of a migraine. C, consider sending the patient to the ER right away. D, after the ER, consider do a comprehensive workup for headache, including MRI and neurological consultation. They are all negative. After the negative workup in E, resume acalabrutinib and a headache recurs, switch to ibrutinib. And F, all the above. So my choice is my choice is F, all of the above. So everybody know that acalabrutinib can cause a headache. The headache usually does not last more than 5 days, and it goes away without a dose reduction with acalabrutinib. But when a young lady with a history of migraine comes, that could become a very bad headache, and you have to stop the acalabrutinib immediately. Of course, if the patient is the first severe headache, no MRI done, you need to ask the patient of a migraine history. You need to, if the patient has migraine issues, send the ER immediately. You have to control the pain because the pain is intolerable. Okay. And after a workup, MRI is negative, no seizures, you know, no nothing, then you resume acalabrutinib. And if the headache recurs, you need to switch to ibrutinib or zanubrutinib or even pirtobrutinib. So basically, it's all of the above.
So, you hear stories about these headaches a lot, particularly with CLL. And one of the things you hear is, quote, that caffeine, first of all, that most patients are not as in kind of condition of this patient, but more like, more nuisance is what I've heard. But I also hear a lot of people talking about caffeine. I don't know whether that is a reality or not. Do you use that?
Very frequently. First of all, headaches in mantle cell lymphoma is not nearly as common as CLL. But the medicine I want to prescribe is a Furoset. Furoset have caffeine in it. It's very, very effective. Of course, the patient can drink coffee, drink tea, and it may not have to take any pills. But the coffee frequently resolve a mild headache.
What's her current status?
She is on acalabrutinib, and he got into a very good PR, and with a residual bone marrow disease, I added rituximab, and after rituximab, about 2 years, she's on the once a day acalabrutinib. And I said, you have been on it for 3 or 4 years, and I wanted to stop. She said, Dr. Wong, I don't want to stop. I have no symptoms. I want to continue. I'm too young. I don't want the lymphoma to come back. She's on acalabrutinib.
Wow, That is really fascinating. So when you restarted the acalabrutinib, she didn't have headaches?
She did not. Yeah. Of course, her migraine has, they give her all kinds of migraine things on the PRN basis. She know when she have a migraine attack, she would stop the drug, immediately use the Imitrax and others to stop the migraine. So she has only two or three migraine attacks that was much less severe than the presentation.
Do you think twice about using acalabrutinib in a patient with migraines?
First of all, mantle cell lymphoma is a male disease in the elderly, okay? Young lady come to your clinic is very rare. So if I have another case like this, I would prefer zanubrutinib.
Another question I have is, in what situations, I don't even know if you can give exactly when you can get, can you not use ibrutinib right now at all, or just in the relapse setting, but in what situations are you actually using ibrutinib?
From the relapse, absolutely, I stay away from ibrutinib. And in the front line, I'm trying to move away from ibrutinib. The data may be looking so good, but the patient is no longer feeling confident about the drug. And there's side effects. There's occasionally very rare, but the sudden death, there's severe outcomes. So that's my advice to all the people listening to this lecture, and try to face away as much as possible. And unfortunately, despite the data.
You talked about combinations of BTK and venetoclax, but what about venetoclax as a single agent in a patient who's already had a BTK inhibitor? Is that a strategy that you use?
If the patient has prior ibrutinib, then ibrutinib, but they were not able to tolerate it, you can switch to the colaborative, no problem. But if the patient had a BTK, covalent BTK inhibitor and already, you know, resistant, the response is going to be very low, and it's a waste of time and money and the patient's time. And so you can consider pirtobrutinib in this case.
In what situations right now are you using zanubrutinib?
So according to the data, right, so my second go-to is acalabrutinib because I led the FDA approval. I know the drug. And then ibrutinib, I know it well too, right? So sometimes the patient prefer then ibrutinib. And so sometimes I have samples. So I think then ibrutinib is a very effective drug, but it is more neutropenic causing than the acalabrutinib.
Another question I had in general about BTK inhibitors, which is ventricular arrhythmias. I mean, we're starting to hear about it in CLL, mainly with ibrutinib, maybe acal, I'm not sure. What about ventricular arrhythmias with mantle cell and BTK?
So I know that Ohio State presented the ventricular arrhythmias with acalabrutinib. Neil, I led the trial for acalabrutinib in mantle cell lymphoma, and I used it very often, almost daily. So in the past since the approval 2017 to now, these 6 years, zero ventricular rate arrhythmias from my experience, of course, in mantle cell lymphoma. So second case, 68-year-old gentleman who originally came from Santiago, Chile, now residing in Houston, came to the clinic with a suspected CLL or lymphoma. The patient's CT scan showed a spleen of 25 centimeters. However, there were no enlarged lymph nodes on the scan. Bone marrow biopsy showed mantle cell lymphoma. He was positive for CD20 and cyclin D1. SOX11 was negative for this patient. WBC is 300,000. So regular, we have 10,000, okay? So with 95% being lymphocytes. So what a therapeutic choice would you choose? A, leukapheresis thing, ibrutinib and acalabrutinib or pirtobrutinib. B, leukapheresis followed by rituximab followed by bendamustine. C, leukapheresis followed by R-CHOP. D, chest CT with an angiogram to rule out the PE followed by rituximab. E, leukapheresis, CT angiogram to rule out the PE, and admit to the hospital for rituximab with a flat rate of 25 ml. When WBC is less than 50, then ibrutinib or other BTK inhibitors. You know, oftentimes we observe the patient with a CLL type, the spleen is less than 20 centimeters, their WBC may be 20, and rest assured that most of this patient will present someday to you with this scenario. I already told you in the lecture that I would use a cutoff of 30,000 lymphocytosis. But sometimes the patient have no symptoms, the community doctor would observe, even with a WBC of 100,000. Okay, so that now this case is came from the community. This case was, he was never seeing me. Now, I first saw him 30K, okay? And he was fine, he was functioning fine, but I did like a PE protocol, CT scan angio. He has a saddle PE, okay? because he probably had this PE for a few years because he's accustomed to it, okay? And he was short of breath, but he didn't even realize he was respiration 20 to 25. He became his normal routine for several years, right? So we leukophoresed him. This case, you absolutely cannot give him any BTK inhibitors. You can kill the patient. Why? Remember, most BTK inhibitors, including the pirtobrutinib, they cause compartment shift phenomena. 70 to 80 times percent with CLL and 30 to 40 times in with MCL. So if you give them more, he's going to have a stroke. He's going to have a bleeding in the eye, you know, more PE, and please don't do that, okay? You need leukophoresis sometimes more than three times to reduce the WBC to a safe level, okay? Now, if you give them rituximab regular dose, again, you can have an anaphylaxis reaction because, you know, the CLL, a lot of people don't care, but they give the rituximab even outpatient because remember, CD20 in CLL is much lower, at least 50% lower than mantle cell lymphoma. Mantle cell lymphoma is full of CD20. You give them, they will have overwhelming necrotic, you know, not only the tumor lysis, but sometimes the reaction is so fast that you don't see the rest of the patient already passed out, okay? So you need to freeze them to 60, ideally give them some chemotherapy followed by slow rate of rituximab in the hospital, okay? Flat rate of 25 ml per hour, and sometimes I have reduced to 12.5 per hour. And the patient, if the patient has any heart problem, you have to monitor them, put them in telemetry. Please remember, even the rituximab we use every day can be very dangerous in these scenarios. So in this patient, the right recruitment, leukophoresis, CT, we rule out PE, admit to the hospital, slow rituximab 25 per hour without escalation, and then maybe after that, you can consider a BTK inhibitor, okay?
What's the current status of this patient?
Oh, the patient's alive and well. After he stays in long-term remission, he has not even received the chemotherapy. He has been ibrutinib, and recently I switched him to acalabrutinib due to the withdrawal. He's a 71-year-old gentleman with a history of mantle cell lymphoma, presented himself to my clinic for continuation of therapies for relapsed mantle cell lymphoma. She was previously treated with R2 or lenalidomide rituximab, I should say, bendamustine rituximab, and ibrutinib. He further relapsed. A tumor of 3 centimeters near the mediastinum and other enlarged lymphadenopathies throughout the body, but less than 3 centimeters. PIX7 is 10% with the molecular variant, the morphology variant was nodular. You know, everybody know that nodular, diffuse, pleomorphic, and blastoid. Nodular being the least aggressive is indolent. So what is your next therapy? Acalabrutinib? Or induction with chemotherapy followed by stem cell transplant, or chemotherapy with a hyper-CVAD, pirtobrutinib, or a range of CAR T cell therapy. First of all, the patient has no significant symptoms, and his relapse is very indolent. The 3 centimeter lymph node is not bulky at all, and a KI7, anything over 30 is aggressive, but he's only 10%. Okay, and the nodular variant. So small bulky, non-bulky disease relapse with indolent features. Do you justify for 71 years to go to CAR T cell? Absolutely not. This case, of course, according to the criteria, he meets the criteria for CAR T cell. But remember, this person, if you give the pirtobrutinib, it can last for a long time. I have a patient on pirtobrutinib for 5-6 years now. So acalabrutinib, you cannot use it because the patient already resistant to ibrutinib. Induction with chemo, remember, relapse setting, you never use autologous stem cell transplant in mantle cell, relapse mantle cell lymphoma, never. The autologous stem cell transplant is only applied for frontline therapy that's being challenged by the triangle study, okay? Chemotherapy with hyper-CVAD, absolutely not. We are in the chemo-free time, we don't use this high. This the patient has a small tumor, a single pill can put him in remission for years. Why use a hyper-CVAT? So pertuzumab would be the answer.
So
a lot of patients would use CAR T cells. I would argue, please don't. This is a very small tumor, and maybe pertuzumab by 3 years, we have a less toxic CAR T in the elderly patient. But don't do this. So that's my opinion.
What happened with this patient?
Oh, the patient is on pertuzumab on the clinical trial. For about 3 years now, and has no need for, still in good remission, and very happy. And I think he was the patient advocate was speaking on his experience with the pertuzumab.
So no tolerability issues with him?
He said, Dr. Wang, could you give me a placebo? I said, no, this trial has no placebo. This is a single-arm trial.
What has been your experience with CAR T, and how do you evaluate patients, particularly older patients or patients with comorbidities, in terms of CAR T?
First of all, when the lymphoma relapsed for 3 times and the Ki-67 is over 50%, and all the patients have a big tumor, all the patient has blastoid pleomorphic, all the patients have P53 mutation. You need to move to the CAR T cell as soon as possible. You need to find ways to control the tumor volume to reduce the tumor as low as possible, followed by CAR T. And you cannot delay CAR T because other therapies only last for a few months, and the patient will get physical condition will get worse and worse, and you will have a much worse condition when you delay the CAR T. So, however, what if the patient has a history of atrial fibrillation? That's very tough. You may want to nodal ablate that atrial fibrillation. I do that all the time. So my good friend, Dr. Kuchendorfer, who came up with the technology, which licensed to Kite, he and I agreed that if the patient has atrial fibrillation, nodal ablation, he's not good to CAR T. Because the arrhythmia rate is just too high. When the patient has fever, CRS, the atrial fibrillation is going to come out. So number one, the cardiac issue is always a tough issue, and you want to use the most definitive therapy to address that. And the second issue is the patient has kidney problems. So I never had too much problem with the kidney problem. If the patient have creatinine 2, I never had any bad experience with the CAR T cells. Okay. The next issue is that the CAR T with the CAR T therapy used to be the CRS and the neurotoxicity we dread of, we are scared of it. But now we have dramatically improved our management with the tocilizumab, with the different drugs, where the neurotoxicity is no longer that feared. But now the number one killer of CAR T patients is no longer CRS or neurotoxicity, it is long-term infections. Post-CAR T, please measure IVIG. If the IgG is low, you absolutely need the IVIG. Okay, you need to start with monthly and gradually every other 2 months on that. Otherwise, the patient has died from neutropenic fever. They have died from fungal infections, histoplasmosis, JC virus, you name it. In the past, we said, we look for the common things. We just keep the zebras. Now, these days, the zebras are becoming common pathogens because our therapy. Think about it, the B cell, right, and T cell. The B cell, we have treated with 3 prior therapies, all containing the rituximab, okay? Our chemotherapy has damaged the patient's immune system, T cell and B cell. And then CAR T will cause constant B cell aplasia. This is a setup for infection, right? The infection, especially pneumonia, is a killer. So you have sinusitis. You better kill the sinusitis because if you don't control the sinusitis early, it will become pneumonia. So this is the skills that you need to acquire that we for the patient post-CAR T, you do not allow any infection to be lingering on. Chronic UTI, culture it, kill it. Sinus problems, you have this recent Nivaj, the operator, you had to watch the sinus. You send the patient to the ENT. If there's an abnormal structural problem, you fix it.
Kind of curious, what's the oldest patient you sent for CAR T with mantle cell?
It was a patient was around 85, and he survived. He's still alive.
What about bispecifics in mantle cell?
I think that that's the future. I think, you know, CAR T cell therapies is laborious, and also they use other T cells a lot. So even after CAR T cell therapy failure, some of the bispecific antibody can still rescue many patients with follicular lymphoma. I'm sure if you do it in mantle, that I have studied the combination of polatuzumab plus mosunetuzumab, CAR T cell patient rescued 100% response. You know, I've used epicurtinib. So those data, I'm one of the first abstract I will be showing the ASH. But bispecific works even after CAR T failures. So we need to probably, CAR T cell therapy hard to combine, but the bispecific antibody can be combined with a novel target agent, so it can even move to the front line. In the front line, you may need only a target agent or rituximab plus a bispecific antibody. You don't need anything. So bispecific antibodies, trispecific antibodies also coming, T cell engagers, that's the big part of the mantle cell lymphoma therapy future.
What about enhancing CAR T? I saw you did a paper with TIGIT plus CAR T. What are some of the other strategies that are being looked at to try to improve the outcomes?
So first of all, how to improve the CAR T? We first are moving the CAR T to the front line, because in the front line, the patient has not received any therapy and the immune system is intact. So we have a window 3 trial with a acalabrutinib as an induction followed by CAR T. And so the other ways is, like you said, is for example, we are using, there's trials, not with us, but there's trials with a BTK inhibitor, ibrutinib combined with a CAR T. I don't know the result. I know the trial is ongoing. And we are there's also some other centers are doing pertuzumab to combine with CAR T, pertuzumab the induction therapy during and out, especially the maintenance. Remember, the CAR T therapy, if their response rate is only 80%, you use pertuzumab, is it going to drive to almost 100%? And then it's such a non-toxic drug, and the maintenance will, you know, dramatically improve the duration. So CAR T cell can be combined with the targeted therapies. That's another area of intensive studies. We are curing the mantle cell lymphoma. I've been at MS for more than 20 years, so a lot of my patients have been in remission for 20 years. So I know it can be cured.
When you say curing it, are you referring more to CAR T or also BTK, venetoclax, and
CR other strategies? CR rating 20 years is my definition for mantle cell lymphoma cure. A lot of people think that 10 years for large cell lymphoma, 30 years for follicular lymphoma, for mantle cell lymphoma, you know, there's no data. I talked to all my colleagues. Would agree 20 years CR.
I'm curious, so where the plateau is in CAR T therapy in mantle cell, how it compares to the plateau with diffuse large B cell?
Unfortunately, there's no plateau in mantle cell lymphoma. So the curve still have relapses. And so I did the Lentizuma 2 study. I have maybe 5 patients after 7 years, they're still in remission. Instead of having 40% of flat rate of large cell lymphoma, mantle cell lymphoma is relapsing, right? So remember, you can use large cell lymphoma aggressive, but R-CHOP can cure 60% of the people. You use R-CHOP for mantle cell lymphoma, there's no cure, right? So mantle cell lymphoma, the curve is still not flat. Unfortunately, that's the nature of the beast. So we have more challenges to cure mantle cell than large cell lymphoma, to be honest with you. You know, and large cell lymphoma, it's amazing. They're 39%, 5 years, still 39%. Not with the mantle cell lymphoma, my friend.
Have you used bispecifics after CAR T and seen any benefit?
Yeah, and I used it in trials, and I'm going to present some good data at ASH.
Anything else you're presenting at ASH that you want to comment on?
So I'm going to present the combination of a polatuzumab, mosunetuzumab at ASH. So I'm going to present some data with a new CAR T cell. You know, brexucarpartogene is approved by FDA. There's a new CAR T cell called liso-cel in mantle cell lymphoma. I presented the primary data in Lugano a month ago, but we have a different subgroup analysis to present at ASH, and that will be something new to mantle cell lymphoma. So a lot of exciting things, Neil.
Globally, how does that data look like compared to Brexi?
There's a severe difference between the product. The efficacy is lower. The durability is lower, but the toxicity is much, much improved.
I saw an interesting paper. I don't know if it's going anywhere, but I was just kind of curious on abemaciclib and copanlisib. CDK seems to be popping up in places I don't expect. I've seen it in prostate cancer. Is there any evidence that CDK is useful in mantle cell?
First of all, CDK 4/6 inhibitors, because the CD4 and 6 is heavily involved in the pathogenesis of mantle cell lymphoma. So ideally, you would try, but all the CDK 4/6 inhibitors orally have response rate of a single agent about 30%. So, you know, 30% for other tumors like breast cancer are huge. For mantle cell lymphoma, the response is too low.
That's interesting.
You
mentioned earlier in your talk another BTK inhibitor, orelabrutinib, I think it was.
Yeah.
What do we know about that? Is that an agent that may come into practice?
Yeah, there's a promising data in China. This is a Chinese drug. I know it is very effective. And response rate is like near 90%. Is a very good combined BTK inhibitor, and that may be they are aiming for. There's a trial ongoing, pivotal trial to get a U.S. FDA approval.
Interesting. I'm kind of curious. You know, mantle cell's not that common. Are there any? But you still hear about advocacy groups out there being very rare diseases. Are there any advocacy groups focusing on mantle cell?
Yeah, there's a lot of people. We know that there's a community on mantle cell lymphoma, community. So people exchange ideas. Although each year about 4,000 people in the U.S. only. But these people are living more than 20 years. So you could imagine the number, prevalence is big. And then you think about the Europeans that even have a little higher incidence than U.S. And the China, the Asian countries, less mantle cell lymphoma, but they're sheer number of population. So mantle cell lymphoma across the whole world is a big health issue. And that's why there's such a big market, overall the whole world globally.
Any other research avenues that we haven't talked about in mantle cell that you think may have promise for the future?
Well, first of all, we do not have the luxury of large cell lymphoma. They have more people, more funding, more people, like 20 times more researchers working on large cell lymphoma. So mantle cell lymphoma translational study need to catch up. So there's only only a few places only do mantle cell lymphoma research. So my lab is catching up with a lot of sample processing. We are studying the pertubrin resistance, ibrutinib resistance, CAR T resistance, and we are trying to find new target for mantle cell lymphoma therapy.
You mentioned transform mantle cell, and I have to admit I've never heard that until you brought it up. What can you talk a little bit about? You know, is it like that? You referred to what you see with CLL and FL also. How treatable or untreatable is it? Does it respond to CAR T or diffuse large B cell therapies?
There's a transformation in many layers. So we don't have a morphologic like Richter's large lymphoma that dramatic. But once the mantle cell lymphoma initially always indolent, and then the key axis is P53, eventually it will become blastoid. It's better for now. We have so many therapies, we keep prolonging them, they would transfer into a very blastoid lymphoma. It looks like large cell lymphoma is still called mantle cell lymphoma with the markers. And, we recently gathering some cases of mantle cell lymphoma when they are terminal stage, they involved to the skin. And you move once the lymphoma in the mantle cell in the skin, the key I see them in near 100%, they stop responding to anything. Maybe radiation. Even CAR T would not work. So this patient, and then sometimes it's in different organs, in the brain, in the lung, when the mantle cell lymphoma in terminal stage is behave like a large cell lymphoma, even Burkitt's lymphoma, no therapy would work. And this is our challenge. We need to bispecifically, we need to combine two, we need to all the combination to save these people. And radiation is the main tool in those cases.
You mentioned blastoid. When you see that, does that change the way you approach these patients? And any other high risk variants that change what you do?
Anytime the patient has a blastoid or pleomorphic, any one of them, p53 mutation or deletion, and blastoid pleomorphic, KIC over 50%, complex karyotype, big bulky tumor, you immediately become very aggressive. Sometimes you have to use chemotherapy. Chemotherapy is not used as often, but chemotherapy is the irreplaceable tool that we use to treat any disease, oncology. So don't forget chemotherapy. They can quickly put the patient in remission and rescue the patient from symptoms. Then you can use targeted therapies for maintenance. So when I see a big tumor, large blastoid, the patient have not received chemotherapy, my go-to regimen is this morning I have a conversation with Dr. Steven Schuster from UPenn, and we discussed the case. He has the patient progress with all kinds of things. So chemotherapy, my go-to therapy is cytoxin, dexamethasone, fractional cytodexamethasone with rituximab and with concurrent radiation, low dose, okay? You only do two fractions and the tumor will crash. So I think a lot of people are using it and they tell me that, Michael, it really works.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Wang, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.